Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Well, hey there, it's Zach, all the way from Chesapeake, Virginia. Creative Control happens to be my favorite podcast. I value Visha's insight and his ability to balance humor with in-depth conversation while occasionally dipping into serious topics. Regardless of whether I've heard of the guest or not, or however long Visha's known them, you really do get the feeling that the two of them have known each other for a long time, and I walk away from every episode feeling like I gained something. I think that's testament to how good of a journalist and conversationalist Visha is. He has a real skill of opening people up. I also enjoy the spicy and lighthearted ribbing Visha does with his guests from time to time. Oh, and while I have you, did you know that for just $6, you can subscribe to the Creative Control Patreon and get access to all kinds of bonus content? And for $10, Visha will mail you one of his t-shirts. And hey, that peachy shirt is pretty cool. Anyway, enjoy the episode and doot doot loot doo. Oh, wait.
Tim Midyat is an influential musician, songwriter, and singer based in his longtime home of Chicago, Illinois. Renowned for his work in the band Silkworm between 1987 and 2005, Midyat has been making wondrous music in other projects, including Bottomless Pit, Deep Tunnel Project, and Mint Mile, among others. On February 23rd, 2024, Comedy Minus One brings us Rough Rider, an excellent and moving new Mint Mile record, which prompted me to welcome Tim back to the show to talk about things like making records, both in his basement studio and at the more professional electrical audio facility, how the feel of a performance can be just as important as the sound of the recording, what may have inspired him to sing impassioned songs about love, sex, mortality, and society. A feeling that time is tight and that some of our cars and shoes might be the last ones we ever need. Eschewing social media one platform at a time, collaborating with great musicians including Joel R.L. Phelps and Nina Nastasia, conjuring Lou, Iggy, and Bowie, one fine day at Abbey Road, making new music, Silkworm reissue plans, touring, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners just like you, who follow and subscribe to this donor-driven podcast and tell your friends all about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, which is the primary and most reliable way for podcasters like me to make a living making shows like this one. This is my primary source of income, and if you can support me and my work at Patreon, please do. As we're speaking, there are monthly prize packs and other perks, ad-free versions of the shows. You get them earlier than everybody else, those sorts of things. More to learn at patreon.com/creativecontrol, and thank you in advance for your support of me and this show. With additional support from Blackbird Music, great record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and also a pretty amazing website, blackbird.ca, which you can visit to order records and have them shipped directly to your house. Again, maybe you want to order the new Mint Mile record, Rough Rider. I would. It's amazing. I did, actually. And you can, too. Visit blackbird.ca for more information about how to do that. Plus, in-kind support from independent businesses like Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 840 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Tim Midget from Mint Mile, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hey, Tim, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you, Vish?
I'm well. It's nice to see you again and talk to you. It's been a little while. First of all, as you may recall, I always ask people, where in the world are you, Tim?
I am in Chicago, Illinois, where I usually am.
That's where you usually are. How's it going there?
You know, it's going all right. You know, it's a little warmer now, and, you know, yeah, we're getting by.
Okay, good. Yeah. Did you have a deep freeze? We had a crazy deep freeze here, like just bonkers.
We did. It was not, well, yeah. Yeah, it was like 25 below with wind chill. That's pretty cold.
Yeah. 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 And then now we're getting, as I'm speaking to you, we're on the cusp of a freakish hot, like it's going to be like above zero here, which for those who like Celsius is warm.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Just wild swings. Anyway, yeah, that's a weird thing. I see. You got a little home studio thing going there?
Yeah, this is my lair in the basement where the band practices, and we do a lot of demo recording down here, and then maybe about half of the records come out. Each record comes out of here because we can't beat it when we go into the studio or whatever.
Well, it looks cool.
What happens?
It looks really good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. It's the best band space I've ever had, that's for sure. So it's nice to be able to spread out a little bit.
It's nice to have it in your home, isn't it? Some people like to separate their work from their home life, but in your situation and mine, it's pretty handy to have it right there, isn't it?
It is. It's nice for recording. Sometimes it's nice to go into the studio and have a little bit of time constraint, you know, because we started practicing after the pandemic, after like a year and a half of not playing at all or really even seeing each other. And then we started just recording every practice, you know, in case we got like the magic take of some new song.
Yeah.
And there's stuff on the record, our new record, that's like, you know, the first time we ever played it and it just had the right feel or whatever. But, you know, you can also dork around with stuff endlessly when you have a home studio. So that's kind of the drawback. You have to edit yourself and not just keep fiddling around with things all time.
I want to ask you about some of those impulsive performances you were just alluding to, I guess, or like the instinctual ones, the ones that happen quick, because I want to say I love this album so much. I actually said it out loud to my wife as I had it playing during breakfast. I've just been listening to it nonstop, and the sound of it and your vocals in particular, like I find it really powerful. And,
that's great.
Yeah, the urgency of it just really gets to me. And it's one of these things where sometimes I come into these chats and I have an angle and, you know, I have some thoughts about it. And I have some, but it's overall the feeling of it. Every song is brilliant, but the feeling of it has a holistic tonal thing for me. And I don't know, that's just me. That's just me listening to it. So I'm word salad here. I just want to commend you. It's a beautiful album.
Thanks a lot. A lot of that's almost all of it's down to the band and the fact that those guys just play really great and are really sensitive musicians or insensitive, depending on what the situation calls for. And a lot of that is Matt Barnhart, too, who recorded everything. You know, he's great. And we're kind of in sync in terms of like our ears and stuff and what we want to get out of things. And we tried to, you know, there's some extra stuff on the record, like keyboards, and Greg Norman plays trumpet on it, and then there's strings on the record and stuff. But we tried not to glue those on top, you know. We tried to sort of work it in with the record so it seemed like of a piece. But that's great to hear. I appreciate that.
Oh, well, you're welcome. Yeah, the strings are powerful in their own way, but very well mixed. It occurs to me that they're... Oh yeah, there's strings, but like they're not. Sometimes people, when they're like, "Okay, got everything down. Now we bring in the horns and we bring in the strings," and you know that costs a lot of money, so we should get our money's worth.
Exactly.
Way up in the mix.
That's what I was just gonna say. I paid for this.
it gives it a real character as well. So I started off saying I wanted to follow up on some of the songs you said sort of were laid down, and those were the takes. Can you identify some of those just for my own interest before we get into some of the conceptual stuff about the songs and whatnot? Can you think of any examples?
I think the most radical one sort of was that first song on the record, Sunbreaking, which is, it's good, but it's first because it sounds a little funky compared to the other stuff. And the reason for that is it was just me and Barnhart and Jeff Panel, who plays drums. For a long time, it was just us practicing because this is pre-vaccine or whatever, and Justin has little kids who couldn't get the vaccine right away, so he wasn't too keen on maybe bringing COVID home. So it was just the three of us playing for quite a while, and we did a much different sounding version of it, and then we kept thinking, well, you know, we'll get the real one later after Justin's in the mix, and then it just never quite felt right. And we literally did, with just Jeff and me and at Electrical, you know, big fancy studio, big fancy drum kit, big fancy all these mics, we did like 10 takes, you know. And it was on a computer, so you just keep going. And we listened to them all, and finally I was like, "Jeff, here's the original one with just the drums. What do you think?" And he's like, "Well, I want to say I don't like it as much because it doesn't sound as good, but that's the one, you know." So we just layered everything on top of that, which is very unusual. You know, normally we just kind of, the normal benefit of recording in the house is you hit it. Like there's a song, Halloween, on that record that we actually did at Electrical in a little demo session with Steve Albini, and that's on our Bandcamp and stuff. But
yeah,
that version we just recorded because we felt, we just called it out and we had the stuff running. And it turned out the way it turned out. And we're like, "Oh, well, that's the new version of it, I guess, you know."
Jeff would have protested because of the, probably, I'm guessing, like the technical playing of it, the performance?
No, not even that. Oh. It's just the way the drums sounded, you know, because Electrical Audio has these awesome drum rooms and stuff. So the drums are like on the Electrical one. And then the one in my basement is like. but, you know, that was the. That's the nice thing about being able to do that. The drawback is you can record everything. The benefit is you can record everything.
Yes. You know? Yes, we've talked.
Like I literally have 100 hours of practice recording. So, you know.
There's a term for this, a clinical term that doctors use. I believe it's called demoitis.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So you're like,
we had times in Silkworm where we would be like, I can't remember what the track was, but it was something that had kind of a gnarly sound to it. And we're like, man, I just don't feel like we're capturing the demo. So I made a CDR of the demo and brought it into the studio the next day because we did the whole thing in electrical, whatever this record was.
Yeah.
And we listened back to it and it was like, you know, it's like, it just sounded like trash compared to what we were doing at the moment. We're like, oh, I guess it was, you know, misguided memory of what we thought maybe it sounded like. And it doesn't sound like that at all.
Well, but you and I both listen to enough music that we know that the fidelity or whatever is obviously important. But for some reason, and I imagine Jeff is you know, it's like, I don't mean to keep harping on Jeff's perception of that song we were talking about, but
no.
He was talking about the sound of the drums and whatnot, or that's how you articulated it. But yeah. feeling is hard to articulate. Yeah. Like, it's hard to say, like, clearly this sounds better, but this one makes me feel something different.
Yeah.
And that's a real, that can be an obstacle for artists and fans. Like,
yeah,
I love this. I love when that band only did 4-track recordings.
Yeah.
They switched to the studio and now it's not the same. That's a feeling thing. Have you, is that what we're kind of talking about?
Yeah, it really matters, you know? And we are 100% feel. Like, if it doesn't sound as good or the guitar, there's definitely stuff even on this record where the mic wasn't quite in front of the guitar amp and it sounds a little weird or, Empty Island is another example off the record where it's like, that's a basement cut and we tried to beat it in the studio and we're like, it sounds better, quote unquote, but it doesn't have the vibe. And then sometimes you get the vibe in the studio and you lose it later. Like, there's a song Brigadier on the record that I think turned out great, but something happened and we're just off a little bit. The last couple times we tried to play it, we're like, let's not play this anymore until we have a chance to, like, you know, play it for 15 minutes and practice sometime and get it back. But that's for us, that's really important just because a lot of it depends on Jeff and he drives the bus, you know, in terms of feel. I always want to play stuff faster for some reason. And he just never goes with it and he's always right. So,
yeah, I find that the record, I mean, Sunbreaking, we were talking about, and it does sound like an anomaly on the record to me. On the one hand, because it feels poppy, like very, very poppy, and I will clumsily probably drop in some influences that I've heard. I'm not saying you can correct me or suggest. No way in hell would I have listened to 80s REM and then came up with Sunbreaking or whatever. Like, I just, there's things that are floating around in my head. You know, certainly Lou Reed comes to mind for me on a few. Bowie, Iggy, pop, like, I'm hearing those things more. But do you think overall, like, I just find, like, I mentioned the tone, it's not necessarily a bright and sunny tone overall, this record, but it's infectious. And do you feel did you feel that? Like, it's a poppier sort of expression for you?
I feel like the last album was sort of more ruminative and a little bit grim, or something. I mean, there are moments like that on it. This record seems sort of more like, I don't know, passionate, for lack of a better word, or something.
Impassioned is a word I thought of. Yeah.
So I don't generally think of that stuff at all when we're doing things, but on some level, when you're curating something for an album, if you're going to contrast stuff, you do it thoughtfully. You don't want it to be too herky jerky, you know, and this record just seemed like it. These songs in particular, there's good stuff we left off the album because it just didn't have the right feel overall. It didn't contribute to it, you know. So, yeah. I don't know. I felt like all this stuff hung together really well, and it kind of painted a picture that I liked. So that's really what it came down to.
Well, your voice, I mentioned earlier, like, I'm really drawn to your vocals.
Oh,
and there's some moments where, I think, is it Brigadier, where it starts with you singing, like, and then the band kicks in.
Yeah,
that's a choice. That's a choice. I think that either, I don't know, when I hear things like that, where it's not a cappella necessarily, but when a band drops out and a vocal is prominent or on its own, I'm like, oh, there's something intrinsically, like, they're trying to communicate clearly. something that without the band clattering around. Do you and as I go through these lyrics, like I hear the passion. It feels devotional in the sense that I feel like there's some love songs in here, but then there's carnality. Like it feels a little like I'm picturing bodies and you know, these sorts of things. Am I on the right track with some of where you were coming from?
Yeah. Here? Well, that name Rough Rider of the record is like, it's the second record we've named after obliquely, not totally on purpose, after a brand of condom. So lifestyle by Silkworm. We are well aware of Lifestyle's condoms when we named it. And then Rough Rider is a specialty device.
I see.
As I understand, I haven't, you know, myself managed to pick any of those up. But it has this kind of multi-layered meaning depending on if it's cultural slang of various kinds. You can go on Urban Dictionary if you want. Or, you know, it's also just literally someone who rides wild horses and breaks horses. So
we have, as you may know, Tim, because I know you follow Canada and its comings and goings really closely, we have our own alternate universe football league called the Canadian Football League. And there is or was, I don't follow that closely. It's really big out here in Western Canada, by the way.
Yeah.
In Ontario, I don't think I've ever had a conversation or... There are houses in my neighborhood fully outfitted with the Edmonton team's like colors. Like it's really serious here. And I'm like, I don't know anything. My point being there is or was I think there were two teams potentially called the Rough Riders, the Ottawa Rough Riders and the Saskatchewan. I think I'm again, I should know more. I'm being a bad Canadian. That's what I thought of right away. Football.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's good. Yeah. That's fine.
So we got football, condoms, rodeos. So something very sort of manly. Manly. It's like a manly name in a weird way.
Kinda, yeah. Okay. Yeah, depends. It could really be anyone. You know, anyone could break a horse. So
back to my earnest line of questioning. What are you trying to communicate as clearly as you can to us as listeners and potentially to your muse here? Because it feels very purposeful.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I'm aware of, and you can't let this get in your head if you're going to, you can make good art and be like kind of overly self-critical, and you can definitely make bad art and be fearless. But I think if you really want to make something that's going to last for a long time, you have to be kind of fearless. So you have to go into stuff that might be uncomfortable to share with other people, you know, and not cloak it too much, you know, because if you... I'm not overly specific about stuff, but like all the things you're picking up on, that's all in there, you know? And I think a lot of it just has to do with getting older and realizing what matters in life is all you take with you, you know, is experience. Well, you don't take it with you, but all you accumulate that's really valuable is just what you feel, you know, and what you experience with other people generally.
Yeah.
And that includes all kinds of stuff, you know. And sometimes it goes awry, or sometimes it's sad or bad. But, you know, in general, like the best things you come across in life are, you know, moments of experience, whether it's eating something really amazing or sex or whatever it is. So.
Yeah.
And people always compare things to sex for a reason because, you know, that's like the one thing in life where you can, and that's really what Sunbreaking is about. You know, it's about, you mentioned that song, you mentioned REM, there's that song Night Swimming.
Yeah.
Same title format, Cloud Busting by Kate Bush, same title format. And I wouldn't be surprised if the first song came after the latter song for a reason, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he took that title off her because she's like the king or queen of essaying that kind of experiential thing, you know, the importance of like physical love and stuff in your life. And it's a little bit different when Kate Bush does it than when, you know, 55-year-old guy from Chicago does it, I guess. But, you know, I wanted to go ahead and get into that. It's not too oblique, I don't think, on that tune, but there's also a long part about how basically we're all going to die, you know, and that's intertwined in the whole thing, you know?
Well, I will say that I pick up on little bits of humor when you write about sex or express You know, Rough Rider, that's a double entendre. Yeah. And for me, it's like I say, I connected more with sports than condoms. But
maybe you should. It's all, maybe I want it all to be in there.
Yeah. I got to, you know what? In general, I got to get out more. I feel like that's the, that's why I have you on the line here, Tim, to push me out of my shells. But there's humor here. One of my favorite exclamations, and again, I'm just going to reference something here to make sure. Of course, I lost it on this computer full of stuff. There's a line here in Brigadier that made me chuckle. Mm-hmm. Get it on with limitations. That to me is a nice encapsulation of being horned up, but being being older. And is that a is that an incorrect interpretation?
That song is sort of, it has all of that stuff in it. And then I wanted to kind of, the thing that inspired me to write that song actually was when the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan, and there was this war correspondent guy, I won't name him because he's probably good at his job or whatever, but he was distraught. But my sense was he was distraught that he wasn't going to get to cover a war anymore, you know, and the whole industry of war entertainment has always been really fascinating and horrifying to me. Because it's such, it's like the absolute worst thing we do to each other. And it's like this, like, it is like a sporting event, you know, or whatever, the way that it gets covered. So I started writing it like that about this guy who was just like, but then it morphed into, you know, this physical relationship, like kind of sexual attraction or whatever to sensual desire for war, for conflict, or for whatever. And then the song kind of spread out and became whatever it's about now. I don't really know. But I think it's about all that stuff. And Get It On with Limitations just came out one day, and I thought it was funny too. And
well, when you, for people who haven't heard it yet,
it fits for everything. It fits for sex. It fits for, it definitely fits for fighting, you know. There's this game that we play about like all this shit happening in Gaza and stuff, you know, there's rules, you know, to war. Oh, well, they shouldn't be doing, well, what do you mean they should be doing that, but they can do the rest of it, you know?
Yeah, right. So there's not, it's not simply a one-dimensional sex album.
I think it
album.
Can be
it's,
any. No. But, you know, maybe. It's got a bunch of stuff in there. And I think that we sublimate, not to get too, I don't know which, is this Jung or Freud? Probably Freud. I think we sublimate a lot of our urges and desires and put them into other things, you know. We put them
watching
into,
sports, for example.
Watching, like, definitely football. Are you kidding? Like
the recent sexualization of football has been really fascinating to me as someone who, I don't really make a big deal about how much I watch. My kids are like, you're like my wife and my kids right now. You're like, why are you watching so much football? You don't like football. I'm like, kind of do like NFL same. Football. I'm sorry. Same. Like, I know it's problematic and
it's gross.
There's lots of issues and the league sucks and all these things.
Right.
But there's something about the beauty of that game. And I mean, my son's thing is like, if you never asked me to play football or whatever, or suggested it to me, I guess. So I don't know what the right word is, because he likes to play basketball. We bond over basketball. And I think he's like, wait a minute, you're cheating on me. You never told me we could like football. I don't like football. Why do you like football? Like, that's the sort of subtext. Yeah. But anyway, I've been following it, obviously, with the Taylor Swift stuff as we're speaking.
Yeah.
And the relationship with Kelsey. It's gotten this, I don't know, I don't recall a football season having that zazz of like a couple. It happens from time to time. Brady and his wife, now divorced, and Jessica Simpson. There's always some person, some woman. But it creates this tension, and unfortunately, I don't know what it is, but something about the demographic in football, maybe it's because they're all dudes. There's always this Yoko Ono component that comes up, and then it gets really, really shitty. And
no,
that's
well,
why
you know what?
It.
It's because it's an intrusion, right? Yeah. Like, I have the same attraction to football, and there are a couple teams I follow. I follow the Packers. I follow the Steelers, you know, fairly rabidly. But, you know, do I think it's a good idea, you know, to football in general, like given what it does to people when they play it? I can't really defend it, you know. It's like fireworks or something like that, I guess.
It's indefensible.
You know, I can't defend it. I can't defend. It's like fireworks or cigars or Steely Dan or whatever. Like I can't come up with a defense, and I don't care to defend it. It just is what it is. And there's something about it that gets you, you know?
Yeah. It's weird. But
I think for dudes, it's a sublimated thing where it's like, it's almost like a carnal kind of outlet, you know, where it's
that's
like,
what I was getting at. Yeah.
It's like, physical. These guys and smashing into each other. You don't have to read too much into it, you know, to get
there. Very, very physical. Yeah. It's tellingly one of the few sports that is North American based. I mean, Canada and America. People play football anywhere else? I don't think so. Some there that I don't really know how to delve into exactly, but
yeah.
There was a joke that somebody made on Twitter many years ago about how, like, it's weird that the sport that requires everyone to wear motorcycle helmets isn't catching on around the world, you know? I related to that. I'm like, it is a fundamentally dumb but beautiful sport, and it's interesting watching it with non-fans because they're like, yeah. hut, and then they just run into each other. Like, what is this game?
And then there's a big delay before the next thing happens.
Yeah, what's like, what is this? And like, I'm riveted.
Basketball. Yeah, basketball, soccer, hockey, there's constant movement. Baseball, there's this whole field thing and things are shifting. It's subtle, happens slowly, but any moment in baseball, something can happen that defines the entire game or something you've never seen before. Football is like just pure, it's war, you know? It's like writ small. It's like a microcosm of war, and that aspect of it is what's appealing in part, you know? And also, like I said, just the raw, brute physicality of it, you know? And you don't have to like get off on it in a sexual way for that to still be part of the appeal of it, you know, the raw physical quality of it. So there's something really, there's something interesting about the game on that front. And I'm sure other people have written about it, you know, eloquently somewhere.
Yeah, no, I hear you there. So do you have a sense of where or why, rather, you chose to write a batch of songs with this loose or, I guess, multi-layered concept of connection with people and communicating and actually, you know, I think love and sex? Like, I think you hinted at it, like you're at an age maybe where this is coming to light, but do you
I think the age thing is mostly and I don't second guess myself. I like promised myself very early on when I started doing this when I was a kid, just do it, you know, don't think about it. If you end up being embarrassed by it later, whatever, but you know, you have to just kind of put it out there no matter what, even if it makes you kind of uncomfortable. So no, the age thing would be more like, if you really want to hear me, you know, someone like me, like, you know, get into this stuff.
And it's very artful, by the way, for anyone listening. Like, it is abstract enough.
Yeah,
I have listened to this record 50 times, and so it's sinking into my head in a way that things are popping out for me. But it's a very artfully, it's not too it's like not water, or something.
It's not watermelon sugar or
yes
or it's WAP. Nothing,
it's definitely not WAP, but it has this like. And then we have to talk about Nastasia's appearance as well. Like, that shifts at the end of the album. You're like, oh, we're in a different universe all of a sudden, but it's
that's
similar.
The idea.
Yeah,
right.
So, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, Tim, but yeah, I just wanted to interject to say it's not in your face for anyone who hasn't encountered the record yet. It is really beautiful, but the passion is evident in the vocal, which I don't want to lose track of. I want to ask you about your singing on this record in particular when we get there, but sorry to cut you off. Yeah. Do you want to finish your thought there about where you...
No, I think the only other thing was... I mean, I think some of it maybe came out of the... definitely came out of being in lockdown and stuff during the pandemic, you know, because I had this one day where I went out, and it was pre-vax, but late-ish in things, and I went to, like, the frame store, and I went to the grocery store. Like, my wife had done most of the grocery shopping and stuff during the whole time, so I hadn't been out a ton. But I went to, like, three different places, and I just had this revelation, like, oh, this is society. Like, you think your friends are your society, you know, your the people you hang with are you know, whatever. And I realized, no, it's the guy at the frame shop that I talked to for 2 minutes, you know, while I'm dropping off the frame, or the people at the grocery store who ask if you want a bag. Like, that's human. That's your life, you know, is having these little connections with people. So I think that that definitely fed into it, wanting to think about, like, what does it mean to be a person? What makes life worth living, you know? And I think it is other people, you know, fundamentally. For me, it's other people. And I think anybody I really like who's, like, my age or younger, for sure, appreciates, like, the duality of humankind, you know, the fact that we make each other's lives worth living, but at the same time, we brutalize each other and are terrible to each other sometimes. So that's always something I've been interested in and thought about and, you know, been fascinated by it to varying degrees. So that's probably in there too somewhere. But
well, earlier you alluded to this line in Sunbreaking, which is, but you know, we're all going to die someday.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, coming from a pandemic era record, it has a certain weight to it, but that's a really, it's an interesting sentence in this song for me, because it does make us all relatable. We are all going to die. No one can outrun that, but we are also, we have been faced for many years, prior to this pandemic, because of whatever else is going on in terms of climate situations like that in Gaza right now. Time is really finite, but I think that notion has been really heightened for everyone, for those who want to pay attention to that.
I think it is.
What I'm seeing now is still a lot of people's heads in the sand about the reality of things, and I get tagged to be a bummer for even wanting to talk about it with people like you. But I do think when I read lyrics and I hear from artists who I admire and they're expressing themselves, I'm obviously bringing my slant to it. But when someone says this in a song about things we have in common, ways we connect, we're all born, we all die, we all love if we are lucky, and we lose love and these sorts of things. And time is tight. Time is shorter than we maybe think.
Yeah, I mean, that's something you become acutely aware of when you're, I'm 55, so it's like, you know, I was thinking about our car the other day. It doesn't have that many miles on it. It's like, you know, 5 years old or whatever. And I'm like, this one might, I could probably ride this car out till, you know, I don't know
this
when.
This car might outlive me. Did you have that thought? This car might outlive me.
I don't think
me.
It'll outlive me, but I've, you know, I've done stuff like looked at my shoes and been like, but I'm pretty set.
You're looking at things like, this could be the last pair of shoes
I'm like,
I own?
I'm like, I think I could run this collection of shoes out to the end. I mean, my Blundstones aren't going to wear out before I die, probably, you know.
That's true. They're hardy shoes.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. So, you know, it's something that you do. The funny thing is, like, looking back on it, you know, we started writing, like, certainly Joel Phelps and Silkworm was writing about sex and death in, like, 1985, you know, when we were kids.
Yeah.
And we all did that because those are two of the big topics of all time, you know, of course. And you just gravitate towards that because you think about stuff like that. But a lot of that writing, I think, was actually pretty good. You know, it was pretty on target. It was pretty trenchant, like having lost a lot of people since then and having had a lot of, you know, a lot of years under our belts and in other ways, I think it was pretty accurate, you know? So, I think that the pandemic had a lot to do with it, just being at this point in my life and having the perspective I have on that stuff really matters. And you also go through a period, most of us in middle age, where you work a lot, you know, all the time. And, that seems like the most important thing in the world to you. And then at a certain point you're like, I don't think I'm really going to remember this. deeply at the end. Not like I don't need to do it to make money and have a life, but have the life that I want, not be penny pinching. But I don't think.
But you're probably going to remember making Rough Rider more than the work assignment.
I'm going to remember playing in this band a lot. more vividly.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other stuff that I'll remember a lot more vividly too, you know, because that stuff really mattered. And I think that's what a lot of the record is about, that, you know, it's about what is it in life that captures you completely, you know, so that you're not distracted. You're not trying to do more than one thing at a time. You're lost in something.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I mean, there's some art that really does that, and that tends to be stuff that really gets me, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, Astral Weeks or a record like that, you know.
This is weird. Astral Weeks keeps coming up on the show. I don't understand.
Oh,
well,
really?
Jay Maskus was on the show recently, and that day that we did the taping, mm-hmm. I ended up on a text thread with two friends who were like, who had 10 rated albums, like, whatever, 5-star number 10 rated albums, Dylan or Van Morrison?
Yeah.
And my one friend was like, it's Van Morrison. And me and my other friend were like, what?
Yeah.
What does he got? He's got Astral Weeks. Yeah. I said Moondance.
Yeah.
And I brought it up to Maskus and he's like, no, Astral Weeks, that's it.
Yeah. I think Astral Weeks, Moondance, St. Dominic's Preview, his band, the Street Choir, Too Late to Stop Now, great record. Veed and Fleece is great. And even his like minor records like Hard Knows the Highway and stuff is like a really odd record. I still like it.
Yeah, but with Dylan, it's like, how many? There's a million. Like,
yeah, he's a genius.
It's not fair. It's not a fair comparison. It's just weird that it keeps coming up. So Van the Man. You know.
But, you know, that record is that record's totemic, you know. For me, at least, that record is,
Astral Weeks.
It's like the first John Lennon solo record. It's almost like a fluky record, how great it is, you know?
Yeah.
As good as those guys are or whatever, but yeah.
No, the Plastic Ono Band record is unreal. It doesn't even.
Yeah. It's magic. Bonkers. And it only happened once and that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Hey, thanks for listening to Creative Control. As always, as you may have heard me mention, I recently lost my day job and I've had a few conversations with people since who've said, you had a day job? I thought your podcast was your day job. When I explained why it hasn't been my day job to a friend, he suggested I should share some of this information with people like you listening right now. So, in short, unless they have some giant exclusive $1 million contract, podcasters are not paid to make stuff by companies like Apple and Spotify. Podcasters do not make any money from streaming royalties. Ad revenue is dependent on a certain threshold of downloads each month, and even if your show is accessed 30,000 times a month, the income you get is actually really minimal. So podcasters like me usually make time in our lives to support our communities and our interests to make these shows, and our most reliable source of income for this work is in fact crowdfunding. In my case, it's my Patreon. So if you'd like to receive ad-free episodes earlier than everyone else, regular newsletters and blog posts, bonus audio content, and support my work, quite literally, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Earlier, you were talking about society, entering society again after some period away from it. I think
I like how you said that. Just made me think of being in a punk band, just railing against society. There's this great band in Missoula that they were a good band called Who Killed Society, which I thought was like the greatest name for a punk band of all time.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
My point being, I think of you sometimes as I navigate these social media platforms, because you come to mind as someone who has said, Facebook, I'm out.
Yeah.
Twitter, I'm out. Like, yeah. you reach a point, it seems to me, you've reached points in your life where you're like, I can't do this anymore. I'm out of these things.
Yeah.
That is also, unfortunately, a reflection of society. And we are very fractured. And I don't want to go on too much of a tangent. I don't know if any of this is swimming around on your record, per se. Maybe you'll draw connections that I haven't.
Yeah.
Can you talk about your relationship with public interaction in our various online public squares versus what you were talking about before?
Sure. There's just... there's a song "Giving Love" on Ambertron. It has a bunch of stuff at the end about basically like getting lost in your fucking phone and like missing the real story of life, you know. And I think people probably do. And there's always something. I remember when TV was called the boob tube and it was going to like ruin your life or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So we haven't learned how to use the internet yet. I don't think probably, but. Yeah, there's this weird inflection point where this shit seems fun and stuff for a while, and then you just realize you're being co-opted, you know, and that's part of it, you know. Facebook is psyops, you know. That's what it is. I mean, 100%. And even I still use Instagram, which is a little more benign because it tends to invite less bloviating about things, but it's usually just pictures of, you know, cats or whatever, but it's the same thing fundamentally. And Twitter, certainly, you know, it's an experiment, and you're the experiment. And at a certain point, even though I always kind of knew it, you feel like you're navigating it, but then at a certain point you realize no. And even if I am navigating it, there's not enough here. I've even found that with this new, like this Blue Sky thing that I'm on that Blue Sky.
Yeah, me too.
App. And it's fine. When it started, it was pretty good. Now I feel like it's just people bitching about stuff like constantly.
I think everyone, a bunch of us on the new things are mad we had to be on the new things.
Maybe, yeah. But it's also people just getting upset about this stuff that's kind of niche, like... or even if it's meaningful, like, why isn't Biden talking about this or that? Or there was one the other day, I was like, I haven't even seen this movie, but I can already tell it's bad because blah, blah, blah. And then a bunch of people weigh in about why it must be bad. No one's seen it, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's a time suck and whatnot. I still am clinging to the notion that in terms of people I follow and information I gather, there's a bit more of an, I don't mean to make myself sound lofty in this because I'm not that bright, but I feel like there's an intellectual aspect to Twitter in particular. Like,
yeah,
you really have to be mindful of all the bullshit now, but they're the people that I think are legitimate people and providing legitimate information are still really valuable to me in an age where I don't, like, look at the coverage of Gaza or the pandemic. Like, you don't get any, they ignore it.
Yeah.
I feel like in your country, there was recently a protest with like 400,000 people, not one outlet covering it, not one outlet covering a protest demanding a ceasefire. And that's insane. Like, not even a bit like, by the way, these people are in Washington or whatever, like nothing, just ignoring it because it's too complicated for or whatever. I don't even. That's bullshit. They have their agendas. My point is Twitter still feels, and I think it's because it's curated in such a way for me. Mm-hmm. More than Blue Sky or whatever, Threads, all these things.
Yeah.
I just feel like I feel still more knowledgeable about what's actually going on thanks to the perseverance of people who are like, this fucking guy is trying to get rid of us all. Fuck him. He's making it worse and worse every week.
Right.
We're hanging in here.
Right.
And maybe something will happen to him.
That's a fair play. Survival play. For me, I didn't miss Facebook for a day after I stopped looking at it. And the same thing happened with Twitter. Like, I just like, I'm a relatively curious person. So, but I don't know. I guess I started, mostly I just got fed up, you know. In the case of Facebook, it was this forced placement of this anti-trans movie thing, and you couldn't get rid of it and you couldn't block it. And I was like, you know, fuck this. Like, I don't, I'm not going to take part in this anymore. But, also, I just think, like, you think you're curious, but it's like playing on your curiosity. It's kind of like taking advantage of your curiosity in a way that's kind of pernicious, I think. And I think it affects people's moods for sure. I mean, the whole doom scrolling thing, that's a real thing. And to tie it back to what you were talking about earlier with the whole we're all going to die someday thing, my feeling about that is that that's a universal truth, and it's been the truth from back a long time ago.
Yeah,
we died a lot earlier a long time ago than we die now. Yeah. Generally, so you know, I think that there are things that are universal truths, and that's one of them. And the fact that we're going to brutalize each other, large in ways, large and small.
Yeah,
the fact that we're going to make each other's lives worth living, absolutely for sure. And I think being in touch with that reality, for me at least, it makes it a little bit less. The specific stuff that's going on now doesn't seem as novel, you know. Even the pandemic or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, shit happens, you know.
Yeah.
That it's not like it's never happened before, so.
No, and it's hyper-mediated. So this real, and depending on your source for that information and the media you engage with, it's a different thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's the crazy, like, these things that are, I don't know, I'm a logical person. I try to be, so. Mm-hmm. I don't see nuance. I don't know. There's just forced nuance because of the fracturing of and people's like, well, that's just your opinion. I'm like, it's not an opinion. These are real things that are happening. Like, you can't just be like, that's just what you think.
Yeah.
I'm just going to do this. Like, no, like, that's where I'm at with it. And right. I do think the things we're talking about, the platforms that we're talking about, are making some people feel more informed than they are. Myself included, probably. But I just feel like...
Yes.
If you're not all on the same page, literally, about what the information is, how are we going to have a society? How are we going to go into the framing store and not have a weird... I went to the framing store yesterday to pick up a couple pieces, as a matter of fact, and we talked about organic farming and regenerative agriculture. It was great. I didn't know these guys. I didn't know the couple that run the store would talk to me about that. I just wanted to pick up my pictures.
Yeah. I guess but one of the things that's interesting to me about the whole Twitter, Facebook, whatever thing is that there are books out there in the world, and they're, you know, pretty long, most of them. They're like 100 some, 200, 300, 400, 800 pages or whatever. And mm-hmm. you can read that thing over the span of time and accumulate knowledge as you're reading it. And in the end, there's a conclusion, and you have, you know, whether or not you remember everything in it or not, you've had the experience of like, delving into something and exploring it and being guided through it. Right.
Yeah.
And the whole bite size deal is no replacement for it. Like, and it's not a replacement. Scale that down to news articles. You know, if you read a long form news article about some EPA disaster in the, you know, in rural America or whatever, there's a lot of suffering and a lot of detail and a lot of fighting and trying to make things better and stuff that you get a real, you actually know, have some idea what it feels like and what's at stake for people. And then if you read a soundbite or you watch a 30-second video of it, it's just not the same deal. And it's not like I'm doing some kind of huge amount of research or whatever. I just think that there's like a...
That's interesting.
It's a cheaper experience, you know what I mean? It demands almost nothing of you to take part
in. There's no narrative arc to doom scrolling. I guess is what you're saying.
No.
There's no structured outline of like, you're going to an act structure, basically. A news article has a very organized flow to it, a beginning, middle, end kind of thing. Whereas you're right. The other media, most of the media we tend or some people consume, there's no resolution to it. You could literally doom scroll for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
It's not just the rest of the day. You would never end. It's endless.
Yeah.
So it's a maw. Yeah. That's a really interesting point that I hadn't thought
exactly.
of.
Exactly.
So
it's a maw. That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. I want to get back to this record in the time we have because we haven't talked about Nina. We haven't talked about Joel. I want to get to those inclusions. I will say in a perfunctory way, Joel's horns are amazing, and I can't wait to talk about that. They stick out and carry these songs. I asked you earlier about your vocal approach. Mm-hmm. I alluded to some influences that I hear.
Sure.
And I wonder if, in an overarching sense, do you feel like you've distinguished yourself as a vocalist on this record compared to maybe other works you've done?
You know, I definitely... there were a couple songs where I'm like, oh, I got to step my shit up here a little bit. Like, especially those two songs Joel played on, because the horn is so closely related to a voice. And I can tell the whole story about how I got Joel to play on the record if you want.
We can talk about that, absolutely, and I don't mean to cut you off. You want to talk about, obviously, but
all right.
I keep saying I want to ask you about your singing, and I don't do it.
His playing was so great on those songs. I was like, what I'm doing was okay, but now I have to try to compete, you know, because otherwise it's just going to be like burp, 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 burp. And then there's this like massive, you know, 8 saxophone thing that comes in and does what I was trying to do better than I was doing it. So I felt pushed by that, and that was really good. I think I did feel like, I don't know, I feel like I'm getting better at that stuff, at singing. You know, in the old days, we would just crap it out in like one take, and that's what you had to live with for the rest of your life. And, you know, that was fine. There's an immediacy to that I find kind of charming going back and listening to it now.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like I belabor it. I just have to get, it's all about feel. Like I was talking about before, like I do most of it. I sing into this mic here through everything I'm going through now with mm-hmm. audio. And, I just do it in the basement until I get it, you know, or if I do it at electrical, it's usually one or two takes because it sounds great in there, and I've got it worked out because I did that work down here to figure it out. But for me, a lot of it's phrasing.
Yeah,
it's not a purely technical exercise. Things have to happen at the right spot so they don't stomp on the drums and they get through. You know, the words get through. And you mentioned Lou Reed, like, you know, if you listen to the way he did some of those Velvet Underground songs later in his career, he would kind of destroy them sometimes, but he was sort of, to my mind, but he was trying to do something else with it. You know, he wasn't just following the same old roadmap. In general, though, he was a genius at getting it to work, you know.
I feel like you're being really thoughtful about your attack on every song. Like, it's really a dynamic vocal performance throughout the record, if I may. Like, you're either singing, you can sing tenderly, you can exclaim every once in a while, you can speak mm-hmm. sing, and to me it all just gets to me. And and so I just want to commend you on it, and I wanted to ask about it because I don't know if you're fans of some of the people I've cited,
mm-hmm.
particularly that sort of Iggy, Lou, Bowie triumvirate.
Well, there's Iggy back there on my back door.
I see Iggy there, and
not one of his better records, but it's a good posture.
It's blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So I don't know if they... I know you're a big fan of, and a student, I suppose, of music. So I don't mean to pick those three out of thin air, but I think between Joel's horns and just some of the overall sonics of the record, it just takes me to them. It takes me to those guys a little bit.
Good. Well, I love... I mean, Lou Reed's one of my lodestars in music for sure. Neil Young. I don't know where the Bowie stuff comes from, except that I know what you're talking about. We started playing Wild as the Wind in the basement sometimes, and we do it sort of based on his version of it off Station to Station, which is my favorite record of his.
Yeah.
So I've listened to that record a couple... That must be what it is. I hadn't really thought about it. I listened to Station to Station a couple times. In that song in particular in recent months. And honestly, that song I think had an influence on this record now that I think about it, because I listened to his version and I listened to Nina Simone's version, and there's something very florid, but also it's not overly romantic in a exaggerated way. It's very personal, that song. It's a great, great song, and our version of it was fine, but you know, if it wasn't going to put on the record, maybe that would seem too on the nose or something.
Well, and by the way, like, as I say, it's really a dynamic record, but I think the song that probably sparked the Bowie thing for me is probably Empty Island. Does that make sense?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
There's just something about it. The way it starts with just like a lone guitar and then everything kicks in.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just takes me back to him a little bit. And again, it's not a heavy handed thing, everyone listening. Like, it's just something I'm obviously, this is my listening experience.
No, that's so, high compliments, all that stuff. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Much appreciated.
Anyway, I just want to say, like, your vocals are, driving. It's one of the most memorable aspects of this record for me. It's your phrasing and your singing. And that's not always the case. People mix Barry things and whatnot, and it feels like you've got it prominent and you had things to say and you wanted to make sure we heard them.
You know, early when I was talking about doing one or two vocal takes, we would always bury the vocals because we were recording with Steve, and Steve, especially at that time, didn't give a shit about singing, you know, we didn't even have a PA in any of our practice spaces for like 20 years. You know, you sing through whatever.
You're talking Silkworm times right now?
Yeah, Silkworm you know, I think once we got to a Bottomless Pit, we started spending more time on that stuff.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
And Latter Day Silkworm, the last three or four Silkworm records. But, you know, you always mixed it down just because that was what you did, I guess.
It's the evolution of I feel like we talked about this when you were all on the show at one point.
Yeah.
I think confidence, you know, coming from post-hardcore myself,
yeah.
And we would scream at concerts when we played, and then when we got to a recording place, we're like, no, lower that. It's just it's a texture. It's like you can't even make out what we're saying sometimes without the lyric sheet. And I think it's interesting that as you get more seasoned as a musician, you just get more confident. And you're like, you know what?
Yeah.
I actually want this up a bit. I'd like the instrument or the singing to be up. I want people to – I'm less frightened of it, maybe. Yeah,
well, and also I don't have to be comfortable with it, really. I think as long as it works, it's okay if it's not – if I'm not 100% on board with it being as loud as it is. I want it to be – you know, why bother, you know, putting lyrics on it if you're not going to –
No, that's it. I love your lyrics too. I maybe didn't get into that as much, but we've hinted at a couple of things. So I'm glad everything's prominent in the mix, and they really do carry the songs forward in so many ways. I do want to ask about Joel, who I alluded to, and then Nita's inclusion as well.
Yeah.
Which is like I said, you mentioned Neil Young. That song in particular feels more like a Stray Gate or whatever. It's closer to like a Neil Young vibe for me there.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry. Let's start with Joel.
Yeah.
This is a monumental thing for those of us who follow Silkworm.
Yeah.
Talk about having him on the record.
Well, I love Joel and I've always loved him. And, you know, when he had left the band, when he left Silkworm, things were rough between us for a while, but we still loved each other and that's persisted through all these years and they didn't stay that way for too terribly long, but I probably learned more about music from him than anyone else I've ever known personally. I think that's almost for sure true because he's such a great musician, but as good as he is at singing and playing guitar and writing music, I think the way he plays the horn saxophone is really, really great. And he's great at all that other stuff too, but there's something about the way he hears things playing sax, it's just bizarre. And I mean, it's not foreign to me. It's not like I've never heard anybody play saxophone before. I'm like, whoa, that's great. Like, I have Ascension that you have on your back wall there. I have
John Coltrane, everyone. Just for those who can't see what Tim's referring to,
I have 40 John Coltrane records and that many Ornette records and that many, you know, Andrew Hill records or whatever, Monk or whatever. So I know about all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I've listened to all those guys, but there's something about the way he does it that's really special. So we had that song Halicleen on the record, and that's more Roxy than Bowie, I think, in the terms of the sound of it. But so I'm like, well, it needs a horn. It needs like that Andy McKay kind of oboe thing or something in it. And no one around here jumped to mind. So I'm like, I wonder if Joel would play on it. So I told him that and that song Scent on the record, which Greg had already put trumpet on. I was like, both those could use horns. And I was like, I kind of want this one to be sort of a heavy metal version of Tusk or something. It's like
Scent is no pun intended. I think it's a centerpiece of the record.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. And, and a lot of it's due to Joel, but, I just sent him the songs and he's like, oh, well, you know, I haven't really played, this is all via email. He's like, I haven't really played in, you know, 10 years or something. So, I always want to hear what you're doing. So I sent him the songs and then I didn't hear from him for like a month and a half. In the meantime, we're puttering around with the record and stuff. And then he sends me these recordings and it's just him playing over the MP3s and it's fucking great, you know. I'm like, great, can you send me these raw, can you send me the tracks? You know, like I'm recording my voice right now separately. Can you, did you do that? Can, oh no, these are just, this is just, I just wanted you to hear kind of what I was hearing. When I, and I was like, well, can you actually do it then? Because it sounds to me like you already did it. And he's like, oh, okay, well, yeah. And then he would send me things that were like, if I use this mic, do you think it would work? I'm like, it's not going to matter. It's going to sound great, but yeah, that would work. And then he'd be like, oh, I did the whole thing, but you know, the fan was on or whatever. And I'm like, it doesn't matter. Just send, you know, we record in the basement. There's HVAC sounds on everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, you know. So then a couple more months go by and I'm like, whatever, you know, I don't know if I'll get it or not. Joel wasn't playing much music, and he's still not, I don't think, at the moment.
It's a little bit elusive and enigmatic still, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he's like a healthy version of Skip Spence or something, you know. But but then he sends me these tracks, and it's just mind-blowing, you know, the stuff that he'd done. And I cried a little bit, and then I told him, like, this is beautiful, man. You know, I can't believe you did this.
Yeah.
And he sent me the broken down tracks and stuff, and then we started working on folding it into the song. And that song, Scent, in particular, just changed the entire song. The thing on Haloclean is it's all surprising.
Yeah.
But the stuff on Haloclean is the effect that I thought it would have. You know, it's this sort of like Roxy psychedelic furs kind of like use of the horn sound, but yeah. he transformed that other song. Like the other song was cool, but it was so much dronier before, and then he like layered it in, and I don't even know what it is now, you know.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful.
Yeah,
it's, again, this is also the product of having a record that's really thoughtfully mixed.
Yeah,
I think that's some of the things we're talking about. It's not simply the choice, like the instrumental choices, it's where they land,
yeah,
and how they affect the mood and tone of the record. So,
and that song was not, there's a lot going on,
yeah, yeah, that's just it. And but I feel like I'm getting a clarity and a definition of every instrument, but it's not
good,
nothing's it's just beautifully mixed, if I may.
Yeah,
so no, that's lovely. Like I say, I think those of us who know your trajectory and relationship with Joel and are wondering what he's up to sometimes. Like, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
It's just beautiful. Sorry, as you were speaking, I thought of something else that I don't know if it's going to resonate with you, but are you a particular Eric Bachman or Archers of Loaf fan by any chance?
It's funny. I just saw him play solo. I'd never seen... I think we played with Archers one time in New York, if I'm not mistaken. It may have been like a CMJ thing or something. But yeah. I just saw him play solo. Jay Ryan, my friend Jay, who's in Dianoga, famous poster. Where you have a Jay Ryan poster on your back wall there.
I have a Jay Ryan poster there and a Jay Ryan poster there. Yeah. There is actually
we got loads of
a Jay Ryan poster, I think, in every room of our house. It was unintentional.
Yeah.
But we have three in our master bedroom. My wife has one over her desk that she loves.
Yeah.
There's a two in the basement, I think. And yeah, my son has one. And I did a favor for Jay in 2020, and he was so grateful that he sent me extra. I order things sometimes.
Uh-huh.
So my son, one of the things he sent was like a Tony Hawk skateboard poster. And at anyway, that's hanging in my, everyone except maybe my daughter, who makes her own art and is very territorial.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's hung her own art. But I think every room basically has a Jay Ryan poster, and Jay has been on the show. Sorry to cut you off. I just want to convey to you.
No.
I love Jay Ryan. And thank you for noticing the art behind me. It's nice.
Jay told me he was having this thing. It was one of these like sort of living room show things. It was in the back of his print shop, and Eric was playing, and I didn't know him, and I hadn't, you know, seen Archers of Loaf play since the 90s. So I went. It was really good. And he's a very nice guy. I got a chance to talk to him and stuff and hang out. But I think that, you know, there's a commonality there. I think we probably have similar record collections. And
it's pretty... I only thought of it because as I was pondering the title track, Rough Rider, it seems to me like something Eric would make on his own. And then as we were talking about Scent, I hear, like, sorry, it's not... I don't usually, like, sorry if this is too whatever, and thank you for not being a jerk about You think I just sound like all these other people, man? And I'm not trying to say that, but
one of the key realizations I've had in life is that I'm not that special. So
it's just that I like, as a music fan myself, I sometimes this line of questioning can lead to, oh yeah, I love them, and I go, oh, I love them too. This is great, and then you kind of have a little shared. And they'll say, oh, I wasn't listening at the time, but yeah, they're in there somewhere. So, of course, it's going to come out subconsciously or whatever. So,
right.
And sometimes this leads to people being like, shit, I didn't even think of that. You're right. You know, these sorts of things. So, sorry if I took us down a wrong road, but I'm just, for those listening, there's lots of interesting vocal things happening on this record, and I am fixated on them, and I'm sorry. Tim.
No, that's great. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
So speaking of great vocalists and people who stir things in me, Nina. Mm-hmm. Talk about having her on this record and the choice you made to have her close out the record with this beautiful song, I Hope It's Different.
Yeah. Well, I think she's brilliant. And I first met Nina when I was in London to master Lifestyle. Silkworm's Lifestyle record, and in one day at Abbey Road, it was that record, Shellac, Thousand Hertz, and Nina's record, Dogs, were all mastered on the same day. So it was a pretty good day at Abbey Road. But I met her and her then partner, Kenan, and loved them immediately. My wife was irritated because I would call and I'd be like, oh, these people, and she's like, oh, your new best friends. Yeah, you told me all about your new friends. And then she met them and thought they were great. So I heard her record, and I remember this very vividly at Southern Studios because some mixing thing had to be done, or Steve had to sequence it. So we went to Southern, and I was like, someone made a record, and it's called Dogs, and you're like, whatever. You know, everyone makes records. So, and I don't think Steve had yet trumpeted it to me. I don't think he'd gotten, I don't think we talked about it that much. And he starts playing this thing, and I was just like, what the, you know. Jesus Christ, like, this is incredible, you know? Yeah. And I think I told her, I'm like, this record is amazing. She's like, oh, really? Oh, thanks. And I'm like, no, seriously. Like, I don't just like stuff, you know? This is, like, blowing my mind, you know?
Yeah.
And then that's probably my third favorite record of hers, or fourth or something.
Wow.
You know? Like, you know, she just eclipsed that a few times over. But I think she's really masterful. I think that she's, like, just the sound of her voice, it's like Patsy Cline or something like that. And I don't think I'm overstating things. I think she has a really special
And she's so unassuming talent. About it. Like, she was on the show last year, not too long ago, like 6 months, 7 months ago. And lovely conversation, a hard conversation for those who may not know that her partner took his own life. And it was a very complicated relationship. And we talked about that. And she was very forthright and candid about it, and I tried to be ginger about it, and we corresponded just a little bit after. I think she appreciated the talk and all those sorts of things, but I was left with, like, this is a genius who is, like, not downplaying it, but, like, clearly is a normal... It's rare when you find, like, a genius person who's not, like, aware of it.
Yeah,
like, exactly. Like, not, like...
Yeah.
It's not sort of in the aura of them. Like, this is our projection, too. Like, holy shit. This person's a genius, so I'm going to think of them as a genius. Whatever they say is genius, but she's clearly a genius and is very down to earth. We talked about Dogs for like 15 minutes, for crying out loud. Not the album, actual Dogs. So anyway, I just wanted to relate. I think she's both a lovely and a generous spirit, and you're right. Her voice on a record where you've got a guy like yourself there singing all sorts of ways, including very gruffly, you have this beautiful ray of... Sorry, I don't want to be a Hallmark card about it, but she's it's a ray of light towards the end. And yet it's not necessarily, I Hope It's Different sounds optimistic, but it's a heavy song.
It is. And that's why I knew she'd have the right touch. She was telling me when she was working, she's like, I'm really enjoying working on this because it's such a contrast to my record, which her last record, which is like Black as Pitch.
Yeah.
And, I thought, well, it's not really a happy song, you know. Part of the reason I wanted her to sing it was I thought she could relate to it, you know, and she did. But I had in mind a couple of people that I know, women, her being one of them, who have been through things where they had to get the fuck out, you know. And that's what the song is. And I thought putting it in that spot, I'm like, I can't sing. I can't do it. Like, I could, but it's not going to resonate, you know. Yeah. Then it's just a guy, like the many facets of a guy, you know. And that's not what I wanted the record to be. I wanted it to be a kind of complete thing about people more. So the fact that she agreed to do it was awesome. And then, it worked out with timing. And she's a pro, so she did it in like 3 takes, you know. Yeah. And she did a perfectly good take. And then she's like, I think I need to do it again, you know. And then she did the one that ended up being on the record. That was the best one, so.
That's cool to hear. And it's striking to me the way you're telling the story. You're saying she had no lyrical input in the song?
No, I don't want to overstate it, because a lot of different things go into whatever inspires these songs and stuff. But she was definitely on my mind, you know, in some way when I wrote it. And I've never told her that, because she doesn't need to, you know, have that, be thinking about that. I definitely wasn't going to tell her it before she went in to sing it, because she needs to just bring to it whatever she wants to bring to it, you know. But it was clearly she tuned into it, you know, completely.
It's striking that this seemed, based on my conversation with her, based on the last album, this has continuity.
Yeah. I think so too. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's her kind of, it's a kind of song she would write.
Yes. Yeah.
And I knew that on some level. It's basically just a kind of a country blues, like, there's a Fleetwood Mac song, Jumping at Shadows, and it's sort of like that song in my mind. But I knew it'd be great if I could get her to do it. And I knew she would want to do it. And fortunately, the timing worked out and she was able to come to the studio and knock it out.
Well, like I say, like I said earlier, I do. It is Nina, but I also think of Neil Young and Ben Keith. And I think of the sound that they would draw out of each other for like a tender song like this.
Yeah.
One, so.
And a lot of that is the string arrangement on that is particularly great. It's Susan Voles, who plays with Poi Dog Pondering and stuff here, and Allison Chesley, who plays music on her own as Helen Money. And it's really, I love both of them. And Allison plays with us a bit now. But that arrangement, and then also Justin Brown, who plays steel guitar and guitar in the band, he's a very, he's like Joel. When it comes to the steel, like he just hears it differently than most people.
Yeah.
And the stuff that he played, that together with the strings on that, I kept cutting my guitar part down the more we played it. And then eventually I'm going to try to Steve Cropper it a little bit here in the background, but I'm not going to step up to the front at all. 'Cause there's enough with the other, you know, people, and the drumming's really great on it. So.
The whole record is, like I say, it's one of my favorites.
That's awesome.
I just want to congratulate you again. It's remarkable. I can't say enough about it. And I know there's only limited copies, so I'm going to order one right after we're done. I think there's 600 copies. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I imagine we would make more. We'll make more if we need to at some point.
Okay.
But the last one sold out. So, you know.
We'll see. I know. That's why I'm already worried, because the Comedy Minus One website will do a great thing where they'll be like, only 200 left. Only 206 left. It's not even vague. It's like they've got a counter every time someone orders one. So I alluded. So yes, obviously the record is out via Comedy Minus One. As we're speaking, as Tim and I are speaking, rather, the record is not out yet. It's going to be out on February 23rd, I believe. Tim, I want to ask you. You alluded to Instagram there earlier. I want to ask you a couple of things. One. Obviously, where can people go to learn more about you and Mint Mile and anything else you want to allude to now? And then future plans. I usually wrap this up by asking if you've got new songs you're working on. There seem to be some Silkworm archival releases that come out sporadically.
Yeah.
Anything forthcoming in 2024 that you want to talk about? And then also, as I say, where can people go to learn more about your comings and goings? Can you do both of those things for me?
Sure. Right. As far as our comings and goings, I don't know. We haven't played since early July, which is strange. But we've been working on new stuff, and we have a whole record ready to go, basically. We'll probably get that done. We're going to try to record it by the end of April. So, but yeah, so there's a whole other albums worth of stuff ready kind of to do there. And really, if people followed me on Instagram, just under my name, Midyet Tim, I think it is. Or there is a band Instagram, and every now and then I'll put something on there. But I'm more reliable than – I thought about just giving up on the band one, honestly.
Yeah.
Because I'm just pretty lame about it. But the Comedy Minus One website is good, or Bandcamp. John Solomon at the label maintains the Bandcamp and does a good job with that. But, yeah, what was the other thing?
No, that was it. Where can people go?
Oh,
and what
are
you
doing? Future. Yeah. Well, yeah. So Silkworm, there's a developer is going to come out at some point, which is the second record we made for Matador. And then after that, Firewater will come out, which was the first record we made with Matador. So those will be on the way. I play in a band called Deep Tunnel Project with John Moore and Mike Greenlees from Tar. And this guy, Jeff Dean, who's a really great guitar player, punk rock guitar player, that he's in a bunch of bands, but that record will be out next month too, and that's a really good album. And then, you know, we'll get this next Mint Mile one out. Like I alluded to earlier, I'm not getting any younger, so you know, it's like Werner Herzog used to take years and years to make movies, and now he just craps them out like every 6 months. And someone asked him about it, and he's like, well, I've got too many backed up. Like, there's no way I'm going to get through them all. I have to cut corners. Like, I can't.
Yeah.
I can't. So I don't think I'm quite at the cutting corners stage yet. So I will not be releasing the iPhone demos as a finished album yet. Right. But maybe in a few years we'll get to that point.
And any other road work for you? I know you play with other people.
I'm hoping that we will be playing some shows. I hate booking shows. I really hate it.
Yeah.
So, you know, last summer we got this deal playing a bunch of shows with the Mountain Goats. That was great. I do contact clubs sometimes to book stuff. I just have to get my shit together and do it.
Yeah.
One of the problems with me is I love practicing. Like, for me, practicing is like, it's my favorite thing about being in a band practically.
Yeah.
So, that is good because it's very easy to practice. Usually all you got to do is get the band together.
Yeah.
But in terms of us getting things together to play in front of people, sometimes it's a little, involved or seems involved to me.
Yeah.
But I did play a bunch with the band Sun in 2019, which was awesome. Those guys have been playing just the two of them as a duo.
Oh, okay.
To great effect for the last year or two. So, I don't know if that'll go on forever or not, but,
Yeah.
You know, I'm hoping I'll get to be on stage for the maelstrom of being in Sun again at some point.
Yeah, I was alluding to that quietly, but I wasn't sure what the status is. Okay, so
yeah,
keeping yourself busy, that's great. Well, again, I commend you on this beautiful album. I wonder if we can go out on a song from it for people to hear.
Oh, yeah.
And if so, can you choose one and tell us why it came to mind?
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah, that's kind of tough, right? There's all sorts of different songs on it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a song on the record called Interpretive Overlook that is pretty bare bones song, but there's something about it that I really like. And there's a little bit of Perfect Day in there.
Absolutely.
The song Perfect Day, but not quite as produced as Perfect Day. And it definitely has Lou's vocal inflection and stuff in it. I like that song a lot. It's kind of, I don't know, maybe not everybody's pick. Or you could play Harlequin, which I think is, you know, you get the Joel Phelps experience a little bit.
I'm happy to play where did we land on Interpretive Overlook? Was that the first thing you said?
Yeah.
I'm happy to do that. We can play a little bit of Joel era oriented music in the intro, just to give people a flavor for Harlequin.
Gotcha. Cool.
So I'll do that. But yeah, you know what? You mentioned Perfect Day by Lou. I was walking home. Something about your record has got me singing Lou songs out loud to myself.
Good.
And Pale Blue Eyes for some reason.
Oh, great.
I don't know why. I was walking with my daughter from school and I just started, you know, whatever, quietly humming and singing that. So I don't know. I'm sorry to be so whatever about it, but your album is going to get me on a Lou kick.
Well, that's good. So, I actually just got a text the other day. It's more pronounced. I mean, Velvets are my favorite band, so whatever. But
yeah.
I got a text from a friend of mine who works at Reckless Records here the other day. And he's like, sent me a picture of Developer, the Silkworm album, and the CD of it. He's like, I was just playing this in the store, and Anthony asked me if it was the new Lou Reed.
And so I said, he's there.
I said, that's, I'll take that as a compliment 100 times out of 100, even if it's meant to be an insult.
It's not an insult at all. I think I'm just being careful because you don't want to suggest that someone is copping someone else. But I feel, like I said earlier, I think these are just nice. It's nice that musicians you love are music fans.
Yeah.
And we all are, right? And whoever makes music has got to have started somewhere and has influences. And some obviously wear them really on their sleeve, and others it's just in there. It's part of their marrow. It's part of them.
Yeah.
And that's where I would suggest Lou is for you. He's just in there somewhere.
Yeah. I think, I've absorbed all of that stuff at a very, very deep level. I actually, just last thing, I watched the Todd Haynes documentary on the Velvets a little while ago, and Todd Haynes is one of my favorite directors, so I was psyched he made that movie, and it's great and stuff. But the splash screen for it was a picture of them sitting around, and I was looking at it, and I was like, holy shit, Sterling has my guitar in that, and the guitar is this ancient Kent guitar, so it's this Japanese brand from the 60s, like, this very particular weird looking guitar that says Kent on the headstock. And it's the exact same, precise same guitar that I bought like 30 some years ago because I liked the way it sounded.
Oh, weird. You know?
And that's probably around the time I was like obsessed with the first Velvets record. And I looked it up. I had no idea. And they're like, it's all over the first
weird
Velvets record.
I've heard of kinship. I've never heard of kentship. That's amazing. That's weird. Clearly, it's one of those things. I bet if you were born at the right time, you might have been friendly with those folks. You seem to have a lot in common, maybe. Maybe that's presumptuous, but I got a feeling about that. Anyway, this is a wonderful song called Interpretive Overlook from the brilliant new Mint Mile record, Rough Rider. Tim, always a pleasure to speak with you. I'm always honored that you make time to be on my little show here. So thanks for this, and I hope to talk to you again, and best of luck in the future.
Right on. Thanks a lot.
Needs something new.
It's always nice to have Tim on the show, and I love this new Mint Mile album so much, as you heard me gush quite a bit. It's called Rough Rider, so I hope you'll check it out. I hope you enjoyed that song you just heard. And thanks again to Tim for appearing on this, the 840th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One Podcast Network and is available just about wherever it is you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. Also, since I've got your attention, if you don't mind, I don't normally ask for these things anymore, but there's some chicanery, monkey business, hooliganism going on as I'm speaking to you with like the Apple podcast chart, and I don't know what's my show's usually on there, and I don't. It's just that people will find it, maybe. I don't know who's looking at these charts, but I also find it a little sus. Anyway, if you can leave a rating or a review, positive, if possible, of Creative Control on your podcasting app, that might actually help increase its visibility on the platform you use. So, sorry to talk all businessy, but, you know, I don't know. I'm on my own here doing my best and could use your help. I'm not on my own. I got you. You help. I know you help. I know you are. You are always helping. Thank you. Speaking of which, you can like or follow Creative Control and me on various social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, Threads. I'm not out yet. There's a link that says follow Vish online. Just click on that and you can figure out where to follow me. Also, please, it's very important if you can, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol. Make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. That is the primary source of income in my life right now. I don't have another job. And there's perks at almost every tier at this point. The $4 tier a month, you get ad-free episodes and you get them earlier than everybody else. At the $6 tier, you get bonus content. And then at the $10 tier, you enter, you get all of that stuff, plus you enter the monthly draw thing. It's random monthly draws for prize packs. And as I'm speaking to you, it's almost wrapping up. By the end of February, I'll be giving away a nice prize pack courtesy of Merge Records. And yeah, if you want to learn about all those things and honest to goodness support me and my work and my life, please do so at patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thank you so much. I also want to thank the fine Alberta record store, Blackbird Music, bricks and mortar locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, but you can learn more about them at blackbird.ca. I also want to thank independent businesses like Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks to Jim Guthrie for lending me music that you hear on the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Tim from Mint Mile. I hope you'll check out that new album and subscribe to this podcast and tell all your friends all about it. And who knows, if dreams come true, maybe John Solomon from Comedy Minus One and I will enjoy a slice of Pizza Trocadero in Guelph someday. It's destiny. Anyway, I'll talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.